Oh, I unmute myself. Marcus Alcoholic, thank you very much, Mark, for asking me to come here today. It's been a while, actually, since I shared like this. I've been going to secular meetings since COVID hit Thailand, I suppose, last February, like everybody else. I think I've been to one physical meeting since then, where we had a space where we weren't on lockdown, and I went to a new meeting for newcomers, where there was 5 newcomers at the meeting. It was lovely. I got sober in the 9th of April 1993 in Mullingar. I was born in England, in Manchester. As Mark said, I'm an Irishman, but I'm kind of a half Irishman of Irish parents. My father was a builder and my mother helped in the business as well. And when I was 9, they bought a farm in Ballymahon in County Longford. So we moved to Ireland when I was 9. He kept the business until I was about 15 in Manchester. He used to go back and forth. And when people say they had a kind of a funny upbringing, I had, because I went from a society, I went from a school where school was something like it is today, to a school where the Schlottin Dreiechter, the magic wand, was used quite a lot. And that terrified me. It absolutely terrified me that people got slapped. We went into the church, the local church in Forgany, if anybody heard of it. It's 3 miles from Ballymahon, and for confession. And he was asking the other kids, did they steal sugar? I mean, I used to put 6 spoons of sugar in my tea. So, I mean, I don't know why anybody would steal sugar. But anyway, that's what he was asking, seemingly. If you wanted to, you stole sugar at home, it was a sin. And the church, men were one side, women were the other side. I had 5 sisters, and we came in late to mass once, and the church, and the priest, old Father Tommy, looked down. He said, "I see the women think they're as good as the men now." So I went from a kind of what I called a kind of a normal society. Well, there was a lot of drinking in Manchester at the Irish Club, but apart from that, to something completely alien to me, you know, and it absolutely terrified me. And I went to a school 3 miles away from where I lived, bypassing the local school. So I didn't even connect with the locals as much as I could have, because they considered me, as Mark said earlier, a kind of a snob, because I hadn't gone to the local school. There was 1 classroom for 8 classes. So they put me in a school where there was 3 classrooms for 8 classes. And then when I was 12, they sent me to boarding school for 5 years. So I always felt strange. And from the minute I went to boarding school at 12 or 13 years of age, I went with the kids that were smoking. I hadn't smoked up to then, but I found them. I found the kids that smoked. And when I was about 14 or 15, I started drinking, and I found them as well. My father was a nice man. He did an awful lot for us, but he had a very bad temper. And when his business started to go bad, which it did when I was about 15, he took it out a lot. He wasn't able to cope with it, and he took it out a lot on the family. And he used to call me, like I suppose a lot of men in Ireland at the time were called, good for nothing and never would amount to anything, and you're fucking useless, and all the usual, you know. I've heard a lot of Irish men saying, my age, saying the same thing. It was just par for the course, what was said. So I couldn't please the man. I couldn't absolutely please my father. So what I could do, I had no control over him. I had no control over pleasing him. But what I found was, when I was about 16, 17 years of age, was I could decide what I was going to drink. I could decide to go out and get drunk, in other words, because I couldn't, once I started drinking at the weekend, I couldn't stop drinking until I was drunk or went into a blackout. But I could control when I was going to do that. That was something that was within my control. So there was times as well where I said I wouldn't drink until the weekend. And that was within my control, because I wouldn't drink. But try and stop me drinking at the weekend. I got a fabulous job when I was 19. I got a job as a trainee psychiatric nurse up in Grange Gorman. If anybody knows, it's St. Brendan's Hospital. It's not there anymore. There was 1,300 patients, and I got a job as a trainee nurse. And it was absolutely fantastic. Money was great. Money was fantastic. It wasn't like a general hospital nurse, trainee nurse, because they had to be in every evening by 9 o'clock. They couldn't fraternize with males. Our nurses' home had males and females living in it. Although it was on separate floors, we could wander. We were treated as adults, whereas the general nurses were not. And we had great money. We had our own key to come in and go as we pleased. So I was free. free of my parents, free of everybody else, and I had fantastic money. And God, did I spend it? God, did I spend it? I went a bit crazy. I stayed in that job 2.5 years and I failed my prelim 3 times. So they kicked me out. So I didn't qualify. But for the 2.5, for the first year was fantastic because we had dances. We went out with all the general nurses for discos. We had parties. It was fantastic. And after about a year, I didn't go to as many parties. I went to a pub that was for old men. I was telling Mark last week that the local bar I drank in, the nurses sat at the front of the bar, at the front as you went in on the left. The locals were next, and then the patients were down the back. And we often drank ourselves to a stupor where we fell asleep at the bar like that. And we'd wake up an hour later, and the barman would put a pint in front of us to welcome us back to reality. And we thought we were the people who were looking after the patients. You know, I could tell lots of stories about that hospital, about things that were done by me and by others that should never have been done. We should never have been in charge of patients because we weren't capable of being in charge of patients. A lot of us, I used to think nearly everybody was an alcoholic in the place, but I'd say about 20% of us was, you know, and we shouldn't have been there because we weren't capable of looking after those people. And while I was there, I got a loan for a car, for a Fiesta, my second car. My first car was a heap of junk. I got a loan of a car, a loan to buy a Fiesta, which was a nice car at the time. My father went guarantor. And within about a month or 2 months after 2.5 months being there, I had smashed that car into pieces. I hadn't kept up the repayments. And I lost my driving license for drunken driving in 1980, when it was nearly impossible to lose your license in Ireland. And that's what it was like. And I had to, I went back to my parents' house, the farm at the time, with my tail behind my, I had no money, I had nothing. And I went on the dole for about 6 months until I ended up fighting with my father. Well, I didn't fight with him. He just bet the fuck out of me because I told him to, and he did. And I left. Anyway, to cut a long story short, that was the worst period of my drinking, that 3 years. Because I had unlimited money, basically, and freedom. And, that was the worst. And then I got a job as a barman, an apprentice barman. And after that, after about a year or 2 years, I got a job as a barman in a hotel in Mullingar. And then I got head barman in a hotel, the Greville Arms, if anybody knows it. And they were opening up Stringfellas nightclub at the time, which was the biggest nightclub within a 100-mile radius. And I was the head barman there. And I was controlling my drinking. Nobody in that hotel saw me drunk. I would close that bar at 4 in the morning, the nightclub, or I'd close the other bar at 12 or half 12 at night. And I'd get all the staff out. And before I'd leave that bar, I'd have about 6 shorts of brandy or vodka, or maybe 8. And I'd bring a couple of pints with me with 4 or 5 brandies in it. So I could get drunk without anybody seeing me. You know, so I was controlling it in that regard. I went into business afterwards. I married a girl and I got into their business and I got shares in it. And I'd done very, very well. But I was still out of control drinking at the weekend and at other times. But I was controlling it more than I had before. My last drunk was not that bad. My last drunk was not as bad as any of the drunks before. I went out. I got drunk, not too badly drunk. I remember coming home. I remember going to bed. And the next day, my wife was like a briar. She told me she had to stay up all night, stopping me from pissing in the wardrobe, from pissing out the door, from walking around outside naked. She had to do all these things, and I don't remember a thing about it. I must have been gone in. I don't know, gone in. Because what I used to do was I'd go out to that bar across the road, and I'd drink about 8 or 9 shorts, and I'd have about 5 or 6 pints, which was a normal, you know, that wasn't big drinking. And then on the way home, in the garden, I'd have a bottle of whiskey hid, and I'd drink most of that before I went into the house. So the people in the bar would not see me drunk. And so I'd be okay going in the door, but of course that drink would hit me later, and then I'd go into the stupor. So I decided to go to AA. I told her I'd go to AA. A lot has happened in between that, but there just isn't the time to. Most people know what I've. I mean, I crashed a car, that car that I'm talking about. I've crashed another car. I'd gone over the canal bridge in Athlone, if anybody knows it. I'd wrecked the car. The right guy that was with me broke his leg in four different places. I walked out of it, you know. So lots have happened, things like that. But anyway, at this stage, I was controlling my drinking to the extent that I could hold down a job. I had a house, I had two cars, I had three kids, I had a wife. But I went to AA and I went to a psychiatric hospital at St. Loma's, I think it's called, in Mullingar, for my first meeting. And I went in, and I think I'll share this. That I went in and there was about 50 people there, about 30 patients and about 20 people from Mullingar. And there was a guy called Charlie sharing. Some of you might have heard this before, but he was doing the chair like I'm doing today. And what he shared, I couldn't believe. What he said was, he said he had been trying to control his drinking, that he'd only drink at the weekend. And that's exactly what I had been doing at the time. And then he said he had children. And he used to lay awake during the week because you couldn't sleep when you didn't have drink. And that was the same for me. When I hadn't drink during the week, I didn't sleep. And when I was drinking, I didn't sleep either. I went into a stupor. But he said when he was lying there during the week, his mind would wander. And he used to think, if any of his children ever died, he didn't hope any of them would die, but he hoped if they did die, God forbid, as he said himself, God forbid that they'd die on a Monday. Because if your child died on a Monday, nobody would begrudge you a drink. You'd be allowed to have a drink. You wouldn't have to wait till the weekend. Nobody could say a word to you. Your son or your daughter had died. And on the Tuesday, there would be a wake in the house. And who could begrudge you a drink or even getting drunk if your child had died and it was you were waking your child? And on the Wednesday, you would be removing the child from the house, the death house, to the church for the removal. And you'd be leaving your child in the hospital, in the church, all on his own. And who could deny you a drink on a night like that? The next day, the Thursday, would be the funeral. And who could deny you a drink on the Thursday, on the day of your child's funeral? Then you'd be into the weekend, it'd be Friday. And actually, if you think about it, who could begrudge you a drink for the next month? Your child had just died. And I looked at him. I said, oh, Jesus, how could anybody share something like that in front of 50 people? But it was exactly the things that I had been thinking myself. Now, as Charlie said, and as I'm saying now, my child never died and I never wished him to die. But that wasn't the way my thinking was. My thinking was so warped at the time that these are the thoughts I had. And I said to myself, well, after this meeting, everybody is going to ostracize Charlie. They're not going to go near him. They're not going to talk to him. Everybody went up and shook his hand at the end of the meeting. I couldn't believe it. I said, what a fucking thing to share in front of people. How could you share anything worse than that? I've heard worse since, by the way. But I identified immediately with Charlie. Charlie was 10 years sober at the time. And he was a great old guy. He shared very well. And he shared from the heart, as an old sponsor of mine said once. And he shared exactly what I was thinking. And after the meeting, a guy called Paddy came over. He was a window cleaner, Paddy. And some of you might know him. And Paddy came over and said, we're having the tea now. And we had a big pot, the usual big pot you get in a hospital. And we went out to the kitchen and we put about 50 tea bags into the pot. And we cut the tea and we drank it. I think we had a jar of coffee there that we used to keep for Americans that came over once in a blue moon, you know, so give them a cup of coffee. But we had tea and we chatted there for about an hour. And then I said to Paddy, he kept talking to me. And I said, well, what do I do now? He just said, well, just keep coming back. Just keep coming back, he said. And that's exactly what I did. I kept coming back to the meetings. I didn't hear many of what people did once they got sober. I only heard the drunk logs. Now, I don't know whether they talked about what they did when they got sober. I don't know if they did that or not. But all I can remember is the drunk logs. And the meetings were an hour and a half. And the first half hour to 40 minutes was the guy sharing like I'm sharing now. And they all shared worse things than Charlie had said. They killed people in car crashes, children, they rode over them. They left people with their family without money. They did this. And then they said, And then we came to AA. And they never told us, at least I never heard what they did in AA, only that they just kept coming back. And that's what I did. I just kept coming back. And I was told at the time not to do anything big, no big changes for 2 years. I believe it's 1 year, but at the time, I don't know whether I misheard, but I heard it was 2 years. So I waited 2 years and I sold my share in the business and I moved to Westport and I lived there for 11 years. I've done a lot since I got sober. The biggest thing recently is when I was 18, 19 years sober, I was in Bangkok at the convention, at the roundup, as we call it. And there was a guy sharing there from Los Angeles, one of the main speakers. And he said that in Los Angeles, every week, now he said it might not be people that live in Las Vegas. He said, but people that were in Las Vegas, every week, there are at least two people with 20 years sobriety that go back out and drink. And I said, well, fuck me, I'm 18 years sober. That could be me soon, you know. So I decided. I went at the time, I think I had sponsored two or three people and it never worked out. It never worked out over the years. I went back into my local meeting and I shared that I was an atheist, that I didn't believe anything else. Only myself was keeping me sober with the help of the people in the rooms and with the help of the steps and everything. But it was myself that was basically doing it. There was no God helping me. There was no Jesus Christ. And within a month, I was sponsoring two women. One woman was 20 years sober at the time or something, and she hadn't got a sponsor because there was no women with more time, and she wanted someone with more time in Bangkok. And she fell out with a sponsee, and that sponsee came to me. So I was sponsoring those two, and I was sponsoring a man with 2 years more sobriety than me as well. And after that, I sponsored another four people at the same time. They all came to me because I told them, and most of the people believed in Jesus Christ keeping them sober, but they still came to me. And I think it was because I got really honest in the room. I didn't just go with the banter anymore. I didn't just say what people say automatically as a matter of course. I told my truth and people listened to it and they liked what they heard. I believe anybody can stay sober in AA any way they want to. If they believe that Jesus or God is keeping them sober, good. That's what's keeping them sober. It's not what's keeping me sober. And what I will say is what I did to keep sober, what I believe in keeps me sober. And I won't say anything about what anybody else says. It's up to them. If it works for them, that's fine. But I'll tell people what keeps me sober. And I've changed direction on that over the years because I need different things to keep me sober. I've gone over my time, Mark. Thank you, everyone, for listening to me.